we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello, welcome to Fusion Patrol. I'm your host, Eugene, and tonight I'm welcoming back Simon. Good evening, Simon.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Good to have you. And we are talking about The Prisoner tonight, episode 4-ish, Patty Fritz's free-for-all. Now let's start with a little summary of the episode.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to hearing this because I didn't understand what was going on at all.
Well, that's why the summary is going to be much shorter. The new number two visits number six. He tells him he's worried that in the upcoming Democratic elections for number two's office, he is running unopposed. That's just not good for democracy. Would number six consider running? After a little persuasion, number six envisions that if he could win, he could free the prisoners and himself. But as soon as he agrees, it becomes clear that his campaign has been orchestrated without him. His supporters are already ready with signs made up for him, and the press ignores what he says and just reports campaign platitudes. He is also given the services of number 58, a foreign woman who speaks no English. While it is impossible to communicate with her, she is very enthusiastic to be helpful to him. As a candidate, he must attend the outgoing dissolution of the council. They are motionless zombies, and as he whips himself into a fury, he is taken for brainwashing. Afterwards, he campaigns like a good little puppet. Soon, however, the conditioning wears off, and he tries to escape. He is brought back by Rover and reconditioned again in the hospital. He continues his campaign, but later, at the Cat and Mouse nightclub, the effects begin to wear off, and he begins demanding alcohol, a substance forbidden in the village. To avoid a scene, number 58 takes him to a hidden cave with a still. There, he meets number 2, who is also drinking and somewhat drunk. Number 2 explains that this is a no-surveillance zone, and that they can come down for a drink. 6 soon passes out, and number 2 reveals that he was faking drunkenness, and 6 is once again conditioned to finish the election. It is election day, and number 6 wins by a landslide. He is taken to the Green Dome, and he plays with the trappings of number 2's office. Then, number 58 starts slapping him around, bringing him somewhat back to his senses. He calls on the intercom to the people of the village, telling them that they're free, but no one pays attention. Goons soon arrive and beat number 6 up. Number 58, now wearing the badge of number 2, speaks in English to him. This is just the beginning. Are you ready to talk? The episode ends. Well, let's just put the cards on the table. Did this episode entice you into watching more episodes of The Prisoner?
Well, I don't think there's any question. I'm going to watch more episodes, so I suppose it hasn't put me off.
What if it had been the second episode?
I didn't think it was a terrible episode, but I did think it started quite poorly. And one of the problems was that it did seem to be quite heavy, or not subtle, shall we say, on the allegorical stuff. And it didn't, for me, it didn't make it quite clear enough just what it was having a poke at. I mean, I thought some of the swipes were quite heavy-handed. Let's have a go at the media. Let's poke fun at the electoral process. But it wasn't quite clear to me what kind of were they trying to have a go at democracy in general as a system, or as kind of the Western democracies have instituted it, or was it a go at the kind of democratic sham that you might see? I mean, on either a Saddam Hussein kind of election or a Robert Mugabe kind of election, and those kind of things didn't seem quite clear enough. So certainly in the early parts of the episode, I didn't think it was anywhere near as strong as, for example, the last two episodes that we watched.
I don't care for this episode. It might be my least favorite. I'd have to take a look at the list of the series, and it is partially because it is so heavy on the allegory, but it's also because it's not much story here. It's really number six is not. You know, we discussed this in Chimes of Big Ben. Number six looks like he's ahead of the game in that one, but in fact, he's being run. But then, you know, he emerges triumphant in the end. In A, B, and C, he becomes the hunter and takes them takes them down and wins decisively, even though he doesn't get out of the village. But in this one, he loses across the board. And when it's done, it's not even clear why they wasted their time doing this to him. I mean, he's just bounced around like a rat in a maze in this one.
That I think, is a problem throughout the episode, because it's, first of all, it's not clear to me what exactly the purpose of number two is in trying to persuade number six to participate in this. And indeed going to lengths. The conditioning I found quite odd and confusing, and it wasn't quite clear to me when he was conditioned and what the purpose of that was. Because why would you need him to run? The whole purpose of that wasn't clear. But equally, from the prisoner's side, why did number six agree to it in the first place? Obviously, he thought when he got in charge, maybe he would be able to institute an escape or make a change that allowed everyone to be free. Well, but did he really actually believe that he would ever get to that point?
Okay, so maybe we can draw, modern comparison. You compared Saddam Hussein or Mugabe, but I'll go further. I think you can see some clear parallels to, let's say, President Obama. Here is someone who, throughout his prior career, is very much opposed to things like the NSA spying and the I don't want to say death camps, that's not the right word, but Guantanamo Bay incarcerations and things like that, and who ran on promises and I think genuine concern and desire to make change and make an improvement for everyone. And yet, when you are inducted into the halls of power, the necessity of the game is that you don't necessarily carry through on those things, and that you toe a line that your former supporters would see as completely out of character for you. And I kind of feel that this is what he's getting at in this episode, that he's talking about that politics itself is a corrupting influence, and that entering, no matter what your best intentions are, when you come out the system the other end, you're not.
Well, that certainly seemed to me what part of it was about. And the fact that over here we have these parallels in, just for example, we recently reread A Very British Coup. But it's something that runs through things like Yes Minister, and it's the way in which the establishment owns the politicians, if you like. Mm-hmm. You're fine when you're in opposition. Once you're elected, then you're not going to step out of line or else. And so in some sense, the kind of democratic process is a sham, because in the end, you've still got the same civil service, you've still got the same security service, the police and all the rest of it are going to make sure that you don't rock the boat too much, you don't make too big a change. So it certainly seemed to me that was what he was having a poke at. At other times, he was talking about dictatorships and the idea that there would be no chance of his winning, and what number two wanted was someone to appear to run against him, mm-hmm. much more in the kind of way that the Zimbabwe elections have been run. And so that was part of my problem, not just the fact that it was the allegorical stuff was quite heavy-handed in this, but also it wasn't that pinpointed in terms of who was the target here, who were they actually having a go at.
Well, I think number six definitely, when he went into it, was very clear that he, you know, in a dictatorship, everyone votes for you. He says that,
yeah,
outright. Is it? And I hate to try to put deeper meaning to this episode, because I really don't care for it. But but maybe rightly so, that he is at the beginning of this drawing a difference in his own mind between a proper democratic election and a sham dictatorial election. And number two is showing to him, indirectly, that they're all sham elections. You don't really have free choice. Your candidates end up being the same. You're not going to, you know, it's the illusion of choice, even when it isn't a dictator dictating who is going to win. Although I think we can say that the dictator did, in fact, this case, dictate that number six would win. So it's a little
But that's a twist down the line. The problem is that at this early stage in the process, number six clearly believes that it is a dictatorship. It is not a proper election, that he won't be able to win. And so it's apart from the fact that he doesn't see it as being a proper democratic election in which he can really make a change. So whatever he believes, whatever his good intentions are, he doesn't really believe that the election is the way he's going to make a change, because he sees it as being a dictatorship. Because of that, it's not clear to me why he actually participates. Does he genuinely have a conversion at that point? Or what? When I was watching it, what I kind of assumed, what I was waiting to be revealed, was actually, no, he sees it for what it is. It is a sham. But by playing along, he's playing some kind of double game. He's got some other hidden agenda, which of course never emerged.
Right.
But that's what I've come to expect, because, as you say in the other episodes, the prisoner did end up, if not actually winning in the Chimes of Big Ben, certainly in A, B, and C, he played them and won. But there was no play in this.
No. And yes, completely agree. This is one of the reasons I don't really care for this episode, is that it doesn't really net me a feeling like there's any logic behind what they're doing, that there's any logic behind what he's doing, that it is just a skeleton framework to put the barbs at democracy, freedom of the press, elected councils, whatever, civil servants. You know, the dig about the guy who was doing the interrogation about how he was a civil servant in his former life and he adapted to their techniques immediately. It's all just a kind of a slideshow rather than an episode.
Yes, and it feels forced because it doesn't quite fit into the situation. So if as we're discussing, perhaps the story needs to be about how number six goes into it in good faith, at the start he has to have more belief in the possibility that there being a fair election, which clearly he doesn't. But it's not even clear to me that there is any possibility that the electoral process is the way in which the number twos are put in positions, because I think at some point number two says there are elections every 12 months.
Yeah.
Well, are we supposed to believe that this number two has been in post for 12 months and that it could plausibly be that kind of time period over which the role changes? Because so far we've seen, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, this is our fifth person in that position.
Although as written, this is number two, I'm pretty sure.
You mean this would be the second episode?
Would have been the second episode of the Magoon 7.
Ah, I see. Well, that's interesting, because for one thing, it certainly seemed to me that number six had taken a step back in characterization in this. In The Chimes of Big Ben, at the start of the episode, I noted how calm and contained and measured he'd become, and how he'd become in some way resigned to village life, or was at least playing along with it. Whereas in this, he still seems to be very angry and slightly uncontrolled in his reactions and response, certainly in the way that he rails at the council and in the kind of shouts of, you know, I'm not a number, I'm a free man. Apart from in the introduction, I think that might be the first time we've heard that. So it seemed to me that the character development had taken a step backwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, there's another thing. Do you know who Paddy Fritz is, the writer?
No, I don't.
Well, it turns out it's about one Mr. Patrick McGoohan.
Really?
Yes.
Who he was, wrote it?
And directed it.
Good Lord.
This is... So when he talks about the Magoon 7, this is one of the Magoon 7. This is his vision of the village. It's a more surreal, topical. Answers aren't given to you; just things are put before you. And
so, has he written anything before, or is this his first piece of television writing?
I don't know that. It sure feels like his first piece of television writing to me. But then again, like I said, it has no story, and we could argue that it's, you know, in his view of the tapestry of the prisoner, it doesn't need to have a story, perhaps. That it needs
but,
to be.
But some of the criticisms that I've had of it, in, you know, for example, in terms of how focused it is on its on the targets of its satire, suggest to me that perhaps the writing wasn't sharp enough, mm-hmm. that it did have some more work. And so if there's, I mean, we've touched on the fact before that this is a man with some serious vision. It's incredible what he's realised here. But as a screenwriter, perhaps perhaps he needs a bit more experience in terms of how to turn that into something a bit more honed and a bit more developed before it gets kind of put directly in front of us.
I'll try to keep an eye out for it and mention it in the show. But, you know, he directs it by name in this one, but he writes it under Patty Fritz. There are other episodes that are directed by him that are under a pseudonym. There's certainly at least one more episode that's written by him. I'll have to look at if there's any more. But I'll make sure that I don't miss any pseudonyms as we go along, because he does have his hand in a lot of things, and there's some cases where he wasn't supposed to be the director and the guy backed out at the last minute and he came in. So McGoohan's fingers are all over the place on this one. Couple points from the episode that just spawn some talking points, perhaps. There's the sequence where the press interviews him. Let's step back. There's the scene, going back a little bit to what his motivation is. This is one other possibility. I'm stretching. When he gets up to address the crowds for the first time, he does not make a campaign speech. So there's no campaign speeching to it all. He is simply addressing the crowd. This is his opportunity to hold a microphone and shout at them and say, you know, some of you are complicit with these people and some of you have resigned yourself, and I am going to figure out who is who and sort that out. And perhaps this was just his opportunity to hold them as an audience and speak to them. Instead of a serious attempt at campaigning, he just wants the opportunity to have a mouthpiece, which he has not had up to this point. And the same goes when he goes to the council meeting. He is berating them for their zombiness, if you will. But it seems pointless, except that perhaps this is just his opportunity now. I have that script book that has a lot of the cut scenes in it. One of the changes between the script and what was shown in the air was that the city council, the town council, the village council, I suppose it would be, are not motionless or speechless. They are kind of, zombified, and they, you know, parrot back what they're supposed to, or when, you know, number two says all in favor, they all raise their hats and, you know, vote, but they're still puppets, but they're not completely still and motionless as they are in this one. And when he makes his speech to them, they start reacting. He is actually reaching them, talking to them about having brains and once having hearts that may long to be humans. And that's what precipitates, in the original script, him being sent for brainwashing.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
It makes far more sense.
Both dramatically. I agreed that when he took the megaphone early on, you kind of thought, well, maybe he's not serious about running for election, but the chance to actually shout at them and see if he can reach anyone, yeah, I can believe he would take that. And if in the council meeting, from a dramatic point of view, if people had actually been reacting to that, then that kind of counters the feeling that you get that any of this behaviour, the kind of shouting and the cajoling and the attempts to persuade, are quite naive, given that it's been revealed to him, you know, early on in the pilot episode, just how much everyone is actually a puppet of number two. So if you actually get some reaction to that actually says, okay, maybe he wasn't a complete idiot to imagine that he might be able to reach them. As well as from a dramatic viewpoint, actually giving some kind of explanation and purpose to why number two sent him for brainwashing after the council meeting, obviously to the displeasure of number one.
Yes. No tissue damage. Remember that.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
tissue damage. Because he's too important. That's that will come up again, I think, and I don't know in those words, but I think we've seen that elsewhere already, that it's important that he's not permanently hurt. They're allowed to rough him up, but they're not allowed to permanently hurt him. He's too important to their plan. And the other thing, when he is trying to raise the crowd, and they are looking a little, I don't know, they're very quiet. They're not rah, 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 right? They're just placid, and it's hard to say whether they're being thoughtful or whether they're being zombified. But as soon as he finishes saying that, and the number two says, well, it gets the election going, and suddenly they've got his signs ready, his campaign's already shut up, and the look on his face, the prisoner's face, is, one of complete shock. He was totally not expecting that. And it's almost like, oops, I put my foot in it. Didn't realize what was going to happen here. And then he gets swept away with a crowd onto the election events that are going on. And I think it's not till after that, isn't it? That's when he asks number six, what actually happens if I win?
Yes.
And then number six says, well, number one will no longer be a mystery to you and you'll be in charge. So
yeah, presumably it's the point at which he realizes that he might actually, the plan might be for him to be number two. But again, it comes back for me to the question of, well, if he is being manipulated as part of the plan that he should end up as number two, wouldn't that set some kind of alarm off in his mind as to that can't be good for him. It can't be good for him if he's being played in that way. So what's he going to do about it? And you expect him to do something about it. He doesn't. He appears to make the same mistake again, because he addresses the council in the same way he addressed the assembled people, even though in that case it clearly appeared that they were all puppets and that it was all a setup. So number six didn't come out of this looking too smart, I would say.
No, and once he goes past the council point and they've conditioned him, he's not in control. Even when he's shaking off the effects of the conditioning, he's really not in control. He appears to be irrational.
The difficulty that I had with the conditioning, apart from the fact it wasn't too clear, or it wasn't quite clear enough to me, what was it actually going on there, what the effect of the conditioning was that in the portrayal, in the appearance, it's not, because we don't understand the motives behind number six actually playing along with this election, I'm partly expecting number six to put on a front, to play them. And so for him to behave, as it were, as a good candidate and do the things that he's expected to do could be explained by him pretending, by putting on an act. So it's not obvious whether that's purely down to the conditioning, or whether maybe the conditioning is wearing off, but he doesn't want them to see that, or whether it's entirely down to him just playing along, and until that does start to wear off, you don't know what it is that's behind him behaving in that way.
Mm-hmm. It's problematic. It's problematic across the board.
And it's all very theatrical, and it's not quite clear what the purpose is. I mean, obviously, I suppose part of the explanation, if McGowan is directing, is, I guess, that's how he wanted it to appear. But it's overplayed, a lot of it, a lot of the electioneering stuff. It's quite theatrical and daft and not very believable. And
you
wonder
menacing?
Why...
Well, staged. Yeah, I mean, well, staged is staged election. I mean, that's a pretty strong metaphor. It's beat you over the head with it. It's theatrical.
Well,
it's staged.
Yeah. But it needs to be clear that it's the kind of that overplaying is being done deliberately and intentionally rather than
I think
just
that
being...
is clear. Not through necessarily through the episode, but it is. It's very clear when he wins the election, because dead silence.
Hmm.
No one's paying any attention at that point. The election's over. We're done. There's no more electioneering. He's led to the Green Dome, not to cheers, not to crowds, to just a completely indifferent crowd that's wandering off in silence. The game has been, the show is over, and the audience is milling out. They're not, I, I mean, that's how I took it. When I watched it, it's like, okay, well, we're done. The plot is over. And when the plot, I don't mean the story plot, but I mean the nefarious plot by number 2 and number 58.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going to that staging thing, the reporters, I think I started to talk about this and I didn't, the reporters leap on the vehicle when he's not yet conditioned.
Yeah.
And they're asking him questions and he's saying no comment and they're writing platitudes down. The candidate will make sure our products export to the world. And what are you going to do about security? No comment. Well, everyone will be safe in their homes. And the photographer's on the dash of the thing taking pictures. And when they jump off, they head one direction and number 6 immediately bumps into the identical to the guy of the photographer. And he's printing the tally-ho that has the article already written on it. And, you know, he turns and looks the other direction. And those guys are still going down the street, heading back, presumably, to where they would write up the story. So, again, you know, why would they do that either? I mean, to show us that the news is not real, okay, got it. But all they had to do was to just have him get the newspaper. And I don't know. It's strange. Another thing that's a little bit weird about this episode compared to what we've seen so far is that they have a different numbering system. He makes a comment, number 2, makes a comment to number 6 that number 58, that her number 58 is a lowly number. It's like it's less important. So you're kind of getting that, number 1 is the most important, number 2 is the most important. So that puts number 6 pretty high up in the importance. I wonder who are 5, 4, and 3. You know, what
who's place ahead in the line of succession?
Yeah, and when we got number 8 in Chimes of Big Ben, you know, she's nearly up there with number 6, not maybe less important prisoner. But yeah, number 58's a lowly. And then also the reporter, and I can't remember the reporter's number, but his cameraman had, I think, an A after it, didn't it? So if
yes, it was 113A like, and 113 or something like that.
Yeah. So that was an odd. And the council were 2A, 2B, 2C, 2D, 2E, 2F written on their podiums. So they are a facet of number 2, just like the photographer was a facet of the reporter. And I don't think we see that in any more episodes, but I won't swear to that. But it's a change of pace.
It's picking up, I suppose, on the kind of this thing about the numbers representing. Do the numbers represent a person, or do they represent a position, a post?
Mm-hmm.
Because in the case of number 2, obviously we get a different person, and it's clearly it's intended to show to be a different person each time. And if you compare and contrast that to other examples of this sort of thing where, you know, for example, in Doctor Who, you've got the Doctor being played by a different actor, but it's a device within the show, clearly shows that it's the same person throughout. Whereas if you think about the James Bond film where you've got M, it's kind of much less clear because you know, in some of the early films where you've got M being played by Bernard Lee, and then I think it's Robert Brown. Yeah. And it's not obvious whether that's supposed to be a different person in the same job or whether it's supposed to be the same person just played by a different actor. And then, of course, you go on to Judi Dench and Ralph Fiennes, and clearly you are getting a different person playing the role.
Although Ralph Fiennes actually supposed to be Bernard Lee's M?
Well, that's where it, of course, becomes very confusing. And when I recently read something, writer Jonathan Morris claimed that people in pubs argue about whether James Bond is actually one person or whether it's a code name, which I'd certainly never come across. I'd always assumed that it was one person.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, the point is in the prisoner here, in the case of number 2, you've clearly got the role is number 2. Number 2 is a job. So is that the case with all of the numbering? Is everyone in their number actually totally identified with the role, or do the other numbers simply represent the people?
I wonder if number 6 is supposed to be one better than 007.
I never thought of that.
Neither did I until just that moment. I was like, I wonder if that's why they picked six, just because it's one better than seven.
Yeah, of course. Well, it hadn't occurred to me. But of course, yes, James Bond does have a number. And in those cases, the numbers, I presume, the numbers get reused when someone dies or retires or whatever, in the same way as people from the village have disappeared. You never have two number eights at the same time.
Right.
But when one number eight has gone, then the number is freed up and another person can be given that number.
And you don't move up either. It's not like number nine becomes number eight. They fill the slots.
They fill them up. But in this case, number 58 becomes number two. So there is some movement in some cases.
A couple of other things that are missing that were in the original draft that I wanted to mention. The first is, and this is actually in the final draft, for those out there listening, the language that number 58 is speaking is not Welsh. It's entirely made up.
Why did you think it was Welsh?
I'm just taking a dig at you because you live in Wales.
There was a Welsh phrase. There was a Welsh phrase in it. I've forgotten what it was. But I was very startled, and because I didn't, the rest of it sounded to me, well, obviously I don't speak enough languages to rule out the possibility that it was entirely made up.
It's entirely
But it sounded to me kind of Eastern European. And then suddenly there was a Welsh phrase, and I thought, what?
Well, they shoot down again. Port Marion is in Wales.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
He might have picked that up by mistake.
It's not supposed to be Welsh. So no, it could have come from that. But yes, it was very odd. But I wondered if you'd heard that as well. I asked why you thought it was Welsh, or whether that was just whether I just misheard it or something.
No, I was just having a go at you. But in the original, immediately after his conditioning, when he comes out of the labor exchange, he can speak that language. He speaks to number 58 in that language.
Ah.
So they were getting at something. Maybe they were giving you a hint about number 58 being number two, the future number two, or maybe they were, you know, pointing out that they were inserting, it was more clear that they were inserting ideas into his head or positions or take it, but they removed that. There is the penny farthing bicycle, which we see in the opening credits and is on all their number badges, which has, you know, come to symbolize the village. There's not a whole lot of penny farthing bicycle in the village, but in this episode, apparently that old man who was holding the balloon that popped in his face at one point, he was riding around the whole place on that penny farthing bicycle the whole time.
On the one from number two's, I don't know if we call it an office, but or a different one. Would it have been intended to be that the one in the show? I mean, the kind of one in the office.
I don't know. Because that wasn't, or either wasn't shot or it was cut out. But for whatever reason, there were a lot more definite scenes saying, you know, following up the election campaign comes the old man on the penny farthing bicycle. Or then during the scene, along rides the man on the penny farthing bicycle. And he's the one, and then the only time you see him in the actual episode is he's the guy that's holding that balloon that pops when number six says something, and then everyone kind of laughs at him for a moment. But, you know, he just shows up. But who wasn't in the episode was the butler, who is added into it, where he's, you know, holding up the signs and just occasionally walking through scenes, holding his black and white umbrella, which is totally different from everyone else's umbrella. Why? We don't know, but it's one of those things. Apparently they toned down the penny farthing man and they bumped up the butler. And are you supposed to be looking at it going, why does he have the only black and white umbrella and everyone else has the multicolored umbrellas? I don't know. Also, when the prisoner tried to escape from number two's office at the end and he runs into the room where there's the four guys sitting there staring at Rover.
Yeah.
And they just look at him and ignore him. In the original script, they were sitting there, but they were also all wearing boxing gloves.
Hmm.
It's a weird detail in the script. And you're thinking, now, for some reason, Patrick McGoohan, when he was writing this, thought, these guys should be wearing boxing gloves.
Well, the whole thing seems very odd. I didn't I didn't understand what the purpose of that was.
Me neither. Me neither.
Again, it comes back to the motivation, but it just wasn't clear to me what number 58 or number 2 were doing at that point, and why they had brought him to this point, and then why they had these heavies standing by to give him a going over. I mean, the whole thing is...
Now, that scene was cut out of the original UK transmission for violence.
Oh.
When they hold him and start beating him in the stomach.
Cut out for unconvincing violence.
That too, a little bit, but I guess it was, it is kind of brutal. And you hold somebody down and beat them. That is, that's an unpleasant kind of violence where he can't fight back. But, you know, that's what this whole episode is about, I think. I mean, I'll go out on the limb and say, I think that the intent of the episode was just simply to break number six's will by showing him that we can do what we want with you, and we can make you do what we want you to do. We can beat you up. We can, you know, whatever. And it's one campaign to demoralize him. Seems rather elaborate for that, but I mean, that's the best I can get out of it in the long run. It's just to show him the futility.
The thing about if you take the time to Big Ben, for example, there's a real belief there. He, until the very last minute, he really does have hope. And then, obviously, you know, it turns out that the whole thing is false. In this, it never seems to me that he gets to that point where he believes he has any free will or any chance, really, except for perhaps a moment when he starts flicking the switches and shouting through the tannoy. And so there's nothing there for them to crush, as it were. He already believes that he has no power. So what are they showing him?
I don't know. The futility. Like I said, I think the idea is to break down his individualism.
If you wanted to do that, you would give him something to hope for before you actually break that down.
Yeah. let's just pretend that this is Patrick McGoohan's very first script that he ever wrote. And perhaps, you know, I think he had this big idea. And I think that's really what it comes down to. He has a big idea. And I think you'll see that in perhaps some other stuff that he writes later on. That he's not necessarily trying to convey this in a logical linear fashion. He is just trying to convey this in a series of vignettes or in a non-conventional storytelling technique. Let's put it that way. And that is at odds with some of the other writers who wrote on the show who had a more classical linear narrative style. And I like the more classical ones better personally, because I think they are more internally consistent. Even the science fiction ones like A, B, and C. You have to take McGoohan's vision as part of the whole and wonder if he improved, if he took their scripts and made them more to his vision, perhaps that was really the good thing about the show. Or whether or not, you know, if he had had his unadulterated way, we would probably not be remembering the prisoner all these years later. I don't know. It is.
Well, I think, I don't think the ideas in this story are themselves poor ideas. But, if you wanted to make a criticism of A, B, and C, I think it would be, because it's obviously a high concept story, it is somewhat formulaic. It has a very clear structure to it. Now, I tend to agree with you. I think it works very well as a piece of storytelling and does so within the framework of The Prisoner, which, you know, for which there is credit to McGoohan. The criticism of this episode is very different, I think, which is to do with the fact that it's much more satirical and it fails to it fails to really be very clear in pointing at its targets. It fails to bring things together. Like you say, it's more of a series of vignettes, and it needs work to link them up in a way that gives some coherence to it. It doesn't have to be entirely linear, but the ideas have to work together. And it, to me, it didn't feel like they always were. It felt like you had a whole bunch of ideas, throw them all into the script, but never mind if sometimes they're clashing, so pulling in other directions, you know, not working together enough to kind of bring together whatever it is that the story is trying to put across in some kind of coherent whole.
But the ideas are strong enough, and I say universal enough, that we hear, what is this, 35, 45, nearly 50 years later, 45 years later, I guess, looking at this, and we can say, well, you know, there's some parallels here to Saddam Hussein or Robert Mugabe or President Obama or, I don't know, Nick Clegg. I see Nick Clegg all over this. That's that was who he was. You know, ideas mountain, and the system crushed him. And
I think you give Clegg too much credit.
Well, yeah, for what?
But
you see what I mean, though. I mean, you can take this and you can put it right into today's context of politics, and the satire does work at that level.
I think the ideas are fairly universal. I'm still not sure it works, because I'm not sure it worked then, and I don't think it works any better now. Because again, I come back to this point: are you having a poke at British democracy? Are you having a poke at the kind of Saddam Hussein election or the Robert Mugabe election? You know, the Saddam Hussein election and the Robert Mugabe election are quite different. You, on the one hand, you've got a dictator who basically gets, you know, 99% of the vote in an election, and there is no opposition. Opposition is not allowed. In the other case, you have people who are, I mean, yes, there's intimidation, but people who are overcoming their fear. And then you've got massive electoral fraud going on to win the election. Now, in both cases, you've got a form of corruption, but they're different forms of corruption. And equally, it's different, again, to say the whole idea of democracy itself is, you know, it's a fallacy, an impossible ideal, or however it is you want to have a poke at it. So to me, it's not enough to kind of say, we're going to do democracy, but let's have a few wild stabs at different aspects of it, because there are different things that you could criticize, but those criticisms, if you're not careful, contradict one another. So just what is it that you think is wrong with democracy? Is it a whole concept? Is it the way it's realized? You know, because we've got to take this rather strange, surreal environment that is the village, and we've got to be able to, in some way, make sense of that we can apply it to today's, for us, it's today's politics, but back then it would have been the contemporary world. And yeah, there's stuff in there that we can apply if we pick and choose. But if you ask me, what is it that he's really having a go at here? I'd probably have a guess that it is this idea that whatever you do, the establishment will take you over. But it's not always that. I don't think it's that sharp.
Do you not think that the village itself is meant as a metaphor? Is the wrong word, because it's not that level. But in other words, it's representing society as a whole and the crushing influence of conformity. And I just, you know, I do see this election piece as a logical extension of that. It's the framework of one of the frameworks of society that keeps people under control. Or can be accused of keeping people. I'm not going to express any radical politics here on my my part. But in other words, one of the criticisms leveled at democracy is that it is
a distraction.
Pablum for the masses. It's a distraction to keep you away from seeing what's really going on in society as a whole. And we, you know, our elected officials are not really the people running the government. The election itself really doesn't matter who you vote for. You end up with the same the same net result. And it keeps you away from the idea of revolution, that you feel that you have some control and you have some power in your own destiny. And so you're more vested in it and not an outsider.
But did you feel that that was something that was coming across in the episode? Did you get the sense that the other people in the village believe themselves to have free choice, to have free will in this?
No, that's true. I don't.
Because if they don't, then the whole allegory breaks down.
And you know, I don't get the idea that the village is as a sort of the crushing monotony of society from this episode either. That's just sort of I definitely do not think they should have ever considered showing this episode as the second episode. I really don't. I think that would have been disastrous for the series, because you go after The Arrival, which is an okay episode and has some intriguing ideas in it. And then you throw this surreal sort of aimless wandering right afterwards. I would imagine that probably would have lost them quite a few viewers. Whereas by pulling a couple of strong episodes and putting them right up front, you've got a nice, you know, all right, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. I'll come back and watch again next week.
I'm not sure it would. I mean, I said at the beginning, I'm not sure it would have put me off watching more. And obviously I'm not in the position of a contemporary viewer, because I know of the prisoner's reputation. I'm not likely to give up just because of one slightly less good episode, but that is how I'm seeing it. Slightly less good episode. There, lots in this episode is visually very strong. You know, the action sequences, lots of location stuff. Again, Magoon is very good. The opening of the episode and the kind of very obvious setup stuff around the election and the media or whatever, I did find grated a bit. But once you're through that, I did feel it kind of carried me forward. I did find it entertaining. So I don't know if I would say it was a disastrous episode, but I certainly wouldn't disagree with you that the other two that preceded this, and probably actually the pilot as well, were stronger than this one.
Yeah. No, it is hard to put yourself in the position of contemporary person without, you know, knowing some of the baggage or the reputation that comes with the prisoners. So I don't know. But, you know, that network executives have always been very sensitive to, you've got to get the audience, you've got to grab them the first few episodes. That is a common thing you see over and over again. I know that they did the same thing with Star Trek. They put the first few episodes were not the first few episodes that the people doing the show wanted it to be. They were the first few episodes that the network felt would be the right episodes to grab and pull the audience in for a little bit. So
sure, but I think that's perhaps something that's maybe a little stronger in US television than it is in British television. This was on ITC, so yeah, I mean, advertising would have played into it. But famously, I mean, a number of shows that went out on the BBC, Only Fools and Horses, for example, very poor ratings for the first series. It's because they were back despite that. And that's a whole series, season, as you Americans would say. Mm-hmm. Albeit our seasons are somewhat shorter, typically.
like six.
Like six. I think even if it's not quite as critical to the life and death of a show, certainly for a show like this on ITV, it would have been undeniably crucial that it built up a following. And there would have been more of a chance to win viewers back. But then again, if viewers don't like the second episode you show them, are they going to even give you that second chance? So another thing in this one that we had, I mean, obviously brainwashing features fairly heavily in this, but we've also had alcohol come up as an item in the Chimes of Big Ben. The fact that you have this non-alcoholic vodka and non-alcoholic whiskey, because he makes a point when he arrives at the supposed offices in London that a bottle of whiskey would cost so many credits or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he gets given a drink. I'm not clear whether that actually had alcohol in it or whether it was the non-alcoholic version. In this one, we have still. When the brainwashing is wearing off, he demands a drink and he gets taken to the still, and number two is pretending to be drunk. So I've got two thoughts about alcohol in relation to that. One is, you previously mentioned that McGowan wouldn't kiss on screen, had this very kind of moral Catholic mm-hmm. ethical sensibility. But did that not extend to drinking?
Oh, no, I understand. Mr. McGowan could put it away in real life.
So, yeah, I mean, I just wondered about the other thing was, because in making a connection with brainwashing, something that I recently heard in a talk by John Sweeney, who has done a couple of panoramas and written a book about the Church of Scientology. And I won't say anything more in this podcast because you don't want to be sued.
I don't want to be a suppressive person. Yeah.
But one thing he did suggest in connection with that was that alcohol makes it harder to be brainwashed. And alcohol is obviously not allowed within the village. So I wondered if that might have been a deliberate decision. And if so, what the effect might have been, you know, if he had had a drink in the Chimes of Big Ben, or indeed if what he was being given, I mean, I presume that what he was given when they went to the still was not actually alcohol, did not contain any alcohol. Obviously, it contained something to knock him out.
I think that's probably right. I think it probably was just whatever medication that they were giving him to carry it on. It's interesting. If indeed the producers of The Prisoner were well enough versed on brainwashing to put that in there, I think it's, I don't know if it's to their credit or it's to their detriment that they never bothered to mention that.
Well, I don't know this for sure. It was something that was mentioned almost in passing during this talk, but I just wondered if there was any significance to the fact that he asks for a drink whether he's deliberately doing that when he realizes he's been brainwashed. I mean, I think it's partly because of the kind of depressant effect that when you're relaxed, it's harder to kind of use the standard techniques that might normally work in order to convince you of something or to convince you to behave in a certain way, because more of your natural self, as it were, comes through. So whether it's a universal thing or whether it would not have worked in this particular case, because it's not entirely clear how the brainwashing here works, you know, is maybe beyond the scope of what they're trying to get across in this story. But because it was at least the second time that alcohol has been mentioned, and the fact that alcohol is normally forbidden in the village, I just wondered if there was any deeper significance to it.
I'm surprised you didn't mention then the first conditioning technique with the two lines and the ball and the square, and where he's trapped in that chair and transfixed by the light. They appear to be reading his mind. Did you notice that?
Yes.
They ask him questions, he doesn't answer, and they'll go, nope, that's a lie.
Well, yes, or at least it was some kind of polygraph type thing. Something like that. I mean, it's not clear, but he's clinging onto the chair. So I had no idea how that was supposed to work, how that was supposed to translate into what we saw on the screen.
We had mentioned, on A, B, and C, that, you know, the idea of the drugs, the truth, the brainwashing are pretty outmoded. But it was very interesting because I think the next day I listened to an episode of Skeptoid podcast talking about early CIA brainwashing drug techniques that they tried using, and which sort of directly related, because in the 50s, after the Cold War, it was completely legitimate area of research that they thought that could be done. So this would have been, you know, we speculated that this might have been the thought. Yes, absolutely. During that period of time, it was thought that it would be possible to do all sorts of mind control and effects with drugs functioning on the brain. All that research has been abandoned, as far as we know, because it doesn't work. But back then, as far as into the 60s, it was still an ongoing area of research. And the CIA was funneling a lot of that research through perfectly legitimate research or universities and whatnot. They were giving out grants and having that stuff researched. So it was an active area of concern. So just to put the 60s, the drugs, and the mind control in context for this show, absolutely, they believed that that was, you know, around the corner someday. They thought the Soviets could do it already. So
a 60s concern.
Yeah, a 60s concern. So one other thing. So what do you think about the name of the nightclub? The Cat and Mouse.
I missed that.
When he staggers out of the nightclub, there's a big sign. It's the Cat and Mouse.
Very appropriate.
So there's always the occasional. You gotta keep watching. Gotta keep your eyes open on this show. Well, I think that's. I don't have anything else. Do you?
No, that's covered it.
I think next time we talk about The Prisoner, we will be talking about The Schizoid Man, which is an interesting episode. I think we can say that about all of them. That's an interesting episode.
I think it seems a fair bet. It's
a fair bet that some of them will generate more discussion than others is probably true, but there's certainly an interesting episode. I have a correction from a previous episode. I had mistakenly, I think during our, it must have been Chimes of Big Ben, I had mistakenly pointed out that Christopher Benjamin had been in The Arrival, the pilot.
Yeah.
And said that he was playing the part of Cobb, who was the agent that number six knew and then supposedly jumped out the window and killed himself. That was, in fact, Paul Eddington. That was Paul Eddington. It was my mistake. Christopher Benjamin was the head of the labor exchange that tried to brainwash him with that sort of log-like, spinning, cogging wooden toy that you admired so much.
Yes, that I used to have. Yes.
That was Christopher Benjamin. So he was in the previous episode. I was thinking the wrong character. So, well, thank you for joining me again.
It's been a pleasure as always.
And we hope you'll all join us again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.